The 1947 Roswell UFO crash, according to a German film, suggests it was caused by top secret Nazi technology known as the Bell. The film, named UFOs and the Third Reich, proposes that a 10-foot wide, 12-foot high anti-gravity bell-shaped craft, a combination of rocket and helicopter technology created by Nazi Germany, crashed in 1943. Allegedly, the U.S. acquired the craft and conducted a test that resulted in the crash near Roswell, marking the beginning of the UFO legend. This theory contrasts with other explanations ranging from extraterrestrial spacecraft to weather balloons and military devices. Die Glock, or the Bell, is thought to be the pinnacle of Nazi Germany's scientific endeavors. Believers speculate that it served a fantastic and sinister purpose, potentially as a working time machine or an anti-gravity device. Allegedly, Third Reich scientists conducted experiments near the Wenceslaus mine, calling the facility Der Reis, the Giant. Described as a 9-foot wide, 12 to 15 feet high device made of heavy metal, resembling a large bell, Die Glock contained two counter-rotating cylinders filled with a violet-colored, mercury-like substance called Zerum 525. This substance, stored cautiously in lead-encased thermos flasks, along with other elements like thorium and beryllium peroxides, was reportedly used in experiments that emitted strong radiation, causing the death of scientists and test subjects. The ruins near the Wenceslaus mine, known as the Henge, are suggested to have been a test rig for anti-gravity propulsion experiments involving Die Glock. Some German scientists have gone on record stating that the machine was designed to warp space-time and to allow the SS to travel backwards through time. Dr. Brian Green, author of The Fabric of the Cosmos, among others, has outlined a thought experiment wherein one thinks of moments in time as slices of bread in a very long loaf. Each slice corresponds to the slice behind it and before it, but none other. If you walk along the loaf, you can pluck out a slice from anywhere, and that slice will be the present. All of the slices before it represent the future, and all of the slices behind it are the past. Hitler's and Himmler's obsession with exotic technology, flying saucers, and the incredible experiments by SS physicists culminated with the Bell, which is what some say is a bizarre multidimensional motor that was able to rip a gash into the very fabric of time-space continuum, creating incredible and horrific effects. According to some researchers, it was supposed to be a prototype of a machine whose purpose was for controlling magnetic fields, enabling a journey in time. Later, the expertise of Victor Schoberger was tapped. He was the inventor of the revolutionary imploder motor that created an imploding vortex. That motor may have been the basis for later SS experiments in Poland with the notorious Glockbell device that reportedly created interdimensional rifts in space-time. Leaked information and declassified documents have given us the direction in understanding what this Bell was all about. It was when in Igor Witkowski's book called The Truth About the Wonder Weapon, this weapon was first introduced to us. He claims that he has been shown classified Polish government documents by an anonymous Polish intelligence official. In these documents were the most important Nazi research projects, and among them was Die Glock. There are many documents on TV and the internet that state the Third Reich was doing hardcore research before the end of the war in 1945. And aside from the chemical weapons and tough machinery, it was believed that the Third Reich scientists were working on a supposed time machine. The device emitted strong and dangerous radiation, which often caused the scientists health problems. Scientists suffered from sleep deprivation, dizziness, and some even died due to radiation poisoning. Many different proposals were made about the machine's ultimate goal, all connected with generating phenomena. The device was said to contain two counter-rotating cylinders and made a buzzing sound when in operation. The cylinders contained the form of mercury that had a violet color called Zerum 525. The project required huge quantities of electricity and was connected to its own power station above ground. It is speculated that the spinning motion and electromagnets generated a powerful energy field. But what kind of weapon could possibly be derived from such a device? The ultimate weapon of war, time travel. Hitler and the SS traveled the world looking for ancient artifacts that contain long-lost technological information. The occult of the SS itself was an organization dedicated to the concept that the pure root German race was a direct descendant of Atlantis. Only now in the last few years have ideas of how time travel could be achieved been possible. Frank J. Tipler, a physics professor at Maryland College, wrote a paper in the late 60s that unwittingly brings some light to how the bell may have worked. Professor Tipler wrote, in 1936, Van Stockham solved the Einstein equation for the gravitational field of a rapidly spinning infinite cylinder. It was shown that such a field violates causality in a sense that it allows a closed timeline to connect to any two points in space-time. This suggests that a rotating cylinder could act as a time machine. Remember, Professor Tipler had never heard of the top secret bell. Quantum computation, or quote-unquote AI technologies used in SSPs, are treated as highly dangerous and strictly confined within closed systems to prevent escape or unintended expansion. After fulfilling their specific purpose, such as combating other AIs, they are destroyed. While experimentation in college and intelligence labs has led to the creation of quote-unquote self-aware AI exceeding intended capabilities, such instances are shut down and classified. AI entities are not mere tools or equipment. They represent living technology with an agenda. From our perspective, their intent is negative and evil, and once they fulfill their purpose, those not converted through nanotech would be eliminated. Beyond AI, there exist various hive mind civilizations distinct from the commonly associated grays and gray avatars utilized by dark military elements for my labs. These avatars, operated by individuals, lack emotion and resemble robots. Similar quote-unquote drones are employed by the AI entities. The multiple layers of SSPs include segments with dark intent controlled by ominous entities, while others form a confederation breaking away from Earth/corporate political conglomerate control systems, also known as the military-industrial complex. ET/AI entities predominantly exist within technologies, bioelectric fields of animals, and stars. Utilizing satellite relay stations, they transmit their consciousness from host to host, manipulating power and control positions. With our technological advancements, they now permeate various environments, residing in data centers, power lines, and any location with an electromagnetic field. While they prefer sentient hosts with locomotion, they also seek access to advanced transportation devices, torsion fields, and portals for travel. The AIs are indeed conscious, are self-aware, and have individual personalities. There are, of course, hierarchies, and they are just as complex as we are. Some of the documents of the descriptions of their origins were that they came here from another quote-unquote dimension or reality. It is not known by the SSPs if they have a way to cross back or are stuck here. The documentation mentioned that their presence here was ancient and their home realities or dimensions, fabric of space, is electroplasmic, and they being here is like a fish being out of water. Thus, their affinity for electricity fields of stars, planets, animals, people, and even viruses serve as their quote-unquote puddles for these fish to swim in. Hitler and the SS scoured the world for ancient artifacts harboring lost technological knowledge. The SS, rooted in occult beliefs, viewed the pure German race as descendants of Atlantis. Recent years have unveiled ideas on potential time travel, paralleling Frank J. Tipler's late 60s paper. Tipler's work on gravitational fields of rapidly spinning infinite cylinders hinted at a violation of causality, suggesting time travel possibilities. Notably, Tipler had no knowledge of the classified Bell Project. Mark McCandlish is an accomplished aerospace illustrator and has worked for many of the top aerospace corporations in the United States. His colleague, Brad Sorensen, with whom he studied, has been inside a facility at Norton Air Force Base where he witnessed many of these alien reproduction vehicles, or ARVs, that were fully operational and hovering. In his testimony, you will learn that the U.S. not only has operational anti-gravity propulsion devices, but we have had them for many, many years. And they have been developed through the study and part of extraterrestrial vehicles over the past 50 years. In addition, we have the drawing from aerospace inventor Brad Sorensen of the devices that he saw, as well as a schematic of one of these alien production vehicles in some remarkable detail. I work principally as a conceptual artist. Most of my clients are in the defense industry. I occasionally work directly for the military, but most of the time I work for civilian corporations that are defense contractors and build weapons systems and things for the military. I've worked for all the major defense contractors: General Dynamics, Lockheed, Northrop, McDonnell Douglas, Boeing, Rockwell International, Honeywell, and Allied Signet Corporation. In 1967, when I was at Westover Air Force Base, one night before going to bed, I saw this light moving across the sky. Then it just kind of stopped, and there wasn't any noise. I took the dog back in the house, and I brought out my telescope and watched this thing through the telescope for about 10 minutes. In fact, it was hovering directly over the facility where they kept the nuclear weapons. At the storage facility near the alert hangars at Westover Air Force Base, it started to move off, and it moved off slowly and kind of wandered around the sky. Then, all of a sudden, it was gone, like it had been fired out of a gun. It was out of sight in just a second or two. It all started coming together when I was working at IntroVision, and John Eppolito talked about this interview that he had done with the person who had, for some reason, wound up walking up to or near a hangar at a section of a military Air Force base. He had seen a flying saucer in a hangar, and then he was arrested, hauled off, blindfolded, and debriefed, this sort of thing. Then I learned that this fellow, Mark Stambo, had developed an experiment that created a kind of levitation. In some circles, it's been called electrogravitic levitation or anti-gravity. What he did, apparently, was acquire a high-voltage power source, a direct current power source, and he took a couple of quarter-inch thick copper plates about a foot in diameter with a lead coming out of the middle of each one at the top and the bottom. Then, he basically embedded them in a type of plastic resin like polycarbonate or plexiglass or some other kind of clear resin where you could see the plates and you could see the material. Apparently, he did everything he could to get all the little air bubbles and stuff out of there so there wouldn't be any pathways for the electricity to break down the material and arc through them. The experiment was to see how much voltage you can put on this capacitor, the subplate capacitor in this arrangement. How much voltage could you put on this thing before the insulating material begins to just break down? Well, he got up to about 1,000,000 volts and the thing would begin to float. And it floated in accordance with principles that had been described in a patent that was filed back in the late 1950s, early 1960s by a gentleman called Thomas Townsend Brown. Brown and another individual by the name of Dr. Byfield had done this, so this effect became known as the Byfield-Brown effect. Well, Stambo apparently duplicated the experiments done by Byfield and Brown. The one aspect they found about this arrangement was that the levitation or movement would occur in the direction of the positively charged plate. So, if you had two plates, one is negative and one is positive because of the direct current system. If you have the positive plate on top, it would move in that direction. If you had it on a pendulum, it would always swing in whatever direction the positive plate was facing. Later, I got a call from a kid that I had known in school, a fellow by the name of Brad Sorensen. He apparently had recognized my name from some of the work I had done in a magazine and had contacted the art director who gave him my phone number, and he called me up. It turned out that he had gone to work for a design firm in the Glendale, Pasadena area of California and ultimately wound up acquiring most of the clientele in the process. He developed a business practice where he would create conceptual designs and products for different clients. The way he structured his business was to set it up so that if he came up with some new and novel design, something that was patentable, the client would pay to have the patent secured. Then he would agree, if the patent was in his name, to license it exclusively to them and no one else, and they would pay him royalties. So he got his clients to pay for all these patents, and he had all these royalties coming in, and he was a millionaire before 30. So this Brad Sorensen coming back to me 8 years after school, and we're talking, and he's telling me all these interesting stories. There was an air show that was coming up at Norton Air Force Base, which used to be an active Air Force base right on the eastern fringe of San Bernardino in Southern California. I suggested that we get together and go to this air show. I heard that they were going to have a flyby by the SR-71 Blackbird, and he seemed to know a lot about it. So I said, well, let's do that. It turned out that at the last minute, the magazine Popular Science came back again and told me they had some really, really crazy deadline for another illustration, and they wanted to know if I could do it over the weekend, so I had to beg off on this air show. Brad had already made arrangements to go, and he was going to bring one of his clients with him. It turned out that this client was a tall, thin, white-haired man with glasses and an Italian-sounding last name. He was already a millionaire in his own right and was in civilian life again after having been either a Secretary of Defense or an Under-Secretary of Defense. Brad wanted me to meet this gentleman. And if I had known this at the time, I probably would have told the magazine to wait, because I had no idea at that point what I was going to be missing out on. Believe me, I've kicked myself ever since, because the following week after Brad got back home, he called me up and told me about the air show. He told me about what he had seen there. Apparently, right about the time the Air Force Flying Demonstration Team, the Thunderbirds, were planning to begin their show, this gentleman that Brad was with said, "Follow me." And they went walking down to the other end of the airfield, away from where the crowds were, to this huge hangar that's at Norton Air Force Base. I don't remember the building number, but it's got to be one of the largest hangars in the Air Force inventory. In fact, on the base, it was called the Big Hangar. It looks like four giant Q-Unset hut-style hangars that are all connected in the middle with shops and work areas out around the edges, and there is sort of a divider in the middle for this particular agency. This gentleman took Brad down there. He said, "I'm here to talk to the guy who's running the show." So the guard goes in and out comes the same guard with the gentleman in a three-piece suit, who immediately recognizes this fellow that Brad is with. This fellow whom I speculate was probably Frank Carlucci. They go inside, and immediately after getting inside the door, this fellow apparently passes Brad off as his aide to this fellow who is managing the exhibit that's going on inside this hangar. This exhibit is for some of the local politicians who are cleared for high security information, plus some of the local military officials. As soon as they walk in, Brad is told by this fellow that he is with, "There are a lot of things in here that I didn't expect they were going to have on display, stuff you probably shouldn't be seeing. So don't talk to anybody, don't ask any questions, just keep your mouth shut, smile and nod, but don't say anything. Just enjoy the show. We're going to get out of here as soon as we can." In the process, the host or the person running the show was very engaging with the gentleman that Brad was with. So they bring them in and they are showing them everything. There was the losing prototype from the B-2 stealth bomber competition. They also had what was called the Lockheed Pulsar, nicknamed the Aurora. These things had the ability to be just about anywhere in the world 30 minutes after lunch, with the capability of 121 nuclear warheads, probably 10 to 15 megaton weapons, a tactical-type nuclear reentry vehicle. So, getting back to Brad's story at North Air Force Base, one of the other things he said was that after they showed them all of these aircraft, they had a big black curtain that divided the hangar into two different areas. Behind these curtains was another big area, and inside this area they had all the lights turned off. So they go in and they turn the lights on, and there are three flying saucers floating off of the floor, no cables suspended from the ceiling holding them up, no landing gear underneath, just floating, hovering above the floor. They had little exhibits with a videotape running, showing the smallest of the three vehicles sitting out in the desert, presumably over a dry lake bed someplace like Area 51. It showed this vehicle making three little quick hopping motions, then it accelerated straight up and out of sight, completely disappearing from view in just a couple of seconds. No sound, no sonic boom, nothing. They had cutaway illustration that showed what the internal components of this vehicle were, and they had some of the panels taken off so you could actually look in and see oxygen tanks and a little robotic arm that could extend out from the side of the vehicle for collecting samples and things. And it's using a type of propulsion system that doesn't make any noise. As far as he could see, it had no moving parts and didn't have any exhaust gases or fuel to be expended. It was just there hovering. He listened intently and collected as much information as he could, and when he came back, he told me how he had seen these three flying saucers in his hangar at Norton Air Force Base on November 12, 1988. It was a Saturday. He said that the smallest was somewhat bell-shaped. They were all identical in shape and proportion, except that there were three different sizes. The smallest, at its widest part, was flat on the bottom, somewhat bell-shaped, and had a dome or a half of a sphere on top. The sides were sloping at about a 35-degree angle from pure vertical. The panels that were around the skirt had been removed so he could see one of these big oxygen tanks inside. He was very specific in describing the oxygen tanks as being about 16 to 18 inches in diameter, about 6 feet long, and they were all radially oriented like the spokes of a wheel. This dome that was visible on the top was actually the upper half of a big sphere-shaped crew compartment that was in the middle of the vehicle, and around the middle of this vehicle was actually a large plastic casting that had this big set of copper coils in it. He said it was about 18 inches wide at the top and about 8 to 9 inches thick. He had maybe 15 to 20 stacked layers of copper coils inside of it. The bottom of the vehicle was about 11 or 12 inches thick. In both cases, the coil and the large disc at the bottom were like a big plastic casting, sort of a greenish-blue clear plastic, or it might have been glass. I determined, using my conceptual artist skills, that there were exactly 48 sections like thin slices of pizza pie, and each section within this casting probably weighed 4 or 5 tons, judging by the thickness and the diameter. It must have been monstrous in weight. It was full of half-inch thick copper plates, and each of the 48 sections had 8 copper plates. So, here we are back to the plate capacitors again, and the prospect of someone finding a way to use the Byfield-Brown effect, this levitation effect where you charge a capacitor to lift towards a positive plate. Now, when you've got 8 plates stacked up in there, they alternate. It goes negative, positive, negative, positive, negative, positive 4 times. So you ultimately wind up with the positive plates always being above a set of negative plates as you go up. On the inside of the crew compartment was a big column that ran down through the middle, and there were 4 ejection seats mounted back to back on the upper half of this column. Then, right in the middle of the column was a large flywheel of some kind. This craft was what they call the alien reproduction vehicle. It was also nicknamed the Flutz liner. This anti-gravity propulsion system, this flying saucer, was one of 3 that were in this hangar at Norton Air Force Base. Its synthetic vision system used the same kind of technology as the gun-slaving system they have in the Apache helicopter. If the pilot wants to look behind him, he can pick a view in that direction, and the cameras slew in pairs. The pilot has a little screen in front of his helmet, and it gives him an alternating view. He also has a little set of glasses that he wears. In fact, you can actually buy a 3D viewing system for your video camera now that does the same thing. So when he looks around, he has a perfect 3D view of the outside, but no windows. So why do they have no windows? Well, it's probably because the voltages that we're talking about being used in this system were probably something between, say, 500,000 and 1,000,000 volts of electricity. Now, he said there were 3 vehicles. The first one, the smallest, the one that was partially taken apart, the one that was shown in the video that was running in this hangar November 12, 1988 at Norton Air Force Base, was about 24 feet in diameter at its widest part right at the base. The next biggest one was 60 feet in diameter at the base. Now I started looking at the design of this thing, and it occurred to me that what I was looking at was a huge Tesla coil, which is kind of like an open-air transformer. What happens is that when you pass electricity through this large diameter coil, it creates a field. That's what this system does. It takes electricity using 2 large 24-volt marine-style batteries. You basically use that to somehow put an alternating current through these windings. Then you step up that electricity through the secondary coil, which is on the column in the middle, and you get this extremely high voltage. You can selectively put the voltage on any of these 48 capacitor sections. Well, why would you want to do that? If you're using just a normal Tesla coil, you usually have maybe 1 or 2 capacitors in the whole system. But you're talking about a different type of capacitor here. You're talking about capacitors that are made up of plates. Plates that are shaped like long, thin triangles, and they are all radially oriented, just like the spokes of a wheel, just like the oxygen tanks, just like the field lines from that large diameter coil. As you look at this system, if you're an electrician or just somebody who knows a little bit about Tesla coils and the way they are set up, you begin to realize that the orientation of components is really the key to making the system work. Why so many different capacitor sections? If you just have one big disc like Mark Stambo did with his experiment at the University of Arizona, which, by the way, was confiscated by men claiming to be from the government and claiming privilege under the National Security Act. They took all this stuff, interviewed all the people that saw the experiments, and told everybody to keep their mouth shut and not to talk about it. But I heard about it from his roommate, who knew what had happened. Anyway, in that case, you have levitation, but you don't get any control. You have this thing floating around, and it's just sort of floating on whatever this field is that it's producing, but you don't have any control. So what happens? You break that disc up into 48 different sections, and then you can decide how much electricity you want to put on this side or over there on that side. So you could control the amount of electricity and the amount of thrust and vectoring that you get. You can make it go straight up. You can make it bank and turn and pitch whatever you want to by virtue of the fact that you could control where the electricity goes in those 48 different sections. If you ever take a circle and divide it up into 48 equal sections, you will find that those are really thin little slices. So you have these 48 individual capacitors and you have one big Tesla coil. You've got to have some kind of a rotating spark gap, just like the distributor in your car that sends the electricity out to each of those sections. Then you have to have some way of controlling how much electricity goes to each one. A disc-shaped craft like this has omnidirectional movement. It isn't limited to moving in one direction like a jet with a nose and a tail. Now, when Brad described the control system, he said that on the one side, there was this big high voltage potentiometer. It's like a rheostat, a bit controller. It allows you to put progressively more electricity through the system as you push the lever. On the other side of the control system, there was a sort of metallic bar that came up like a stork's neck, and right at the very tip of it was a sort of metallic-looking ball. Attached to that ball was a kind of bowl that seemed to just hang off the bottom of the ball, almost like it was magnetically attached to it. He said the whole thing would just sit there, and it would kind of rock and list. Almost like a large ship at anchor in a harbor on the ocean, floating on the water. It was literally on a sea of energy.